People are going to lose their minds. This is a moment in history unlike anything humanity's gone through. It's a very different world for humans to come.
Take a step back and see the broad picture, which is the way all these technologies are interlinked.
Because this is all about exponentiality, and humans can't think in exponential terms.
How consequential do you want to say machine intelligence is? It's almost certainly as consequential as writing. How long did writing take to disseminate through the human population? You know, hundreds, thousands of years. And we're dealing with it now on a scale of months.
But in this kind of world, you're compounding 100% growth every year, and the numbers become astronomical.
AI is going to spot patterns in the world that were just completely invisible to us.
Even if you think that the AI and the robots are your demise, you might as well bloody invest in them and make some money out of it. If not, you're just going to be angry man shaking your fists at the clouds.
Is all the good news priced in? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. With me today is Jeremy Schwartz, Global Chief Investment Officer at WisdomTree. Hey, Jeremy, welcome back.
Maggie, thank you so much for having me.
So November was a huge month, and we started off December in similar fashion. We had a big rally in stocks, in bonds, the 10-year yield now at 4.22%. Gold was up, crypto is up. Before we jump in and I get your thoughts, I just wanted to play some highlights from some conversations we've been having all week as we discuss what's driving this momentum. Let's have a listen.
They have not achieved their inflation outcomes, but we are very much making progress towards that outcome from their perspective. And not only are we making progress towards that outcome from their perspective, they're going to have to revise down their 2022 inflation projections, which may, just from a base effect perspective, cause them to revise down their 24 and 25 inflation projections.
You know, if you Powell, things look pretty good right now. I mean, you've pulled out that soft landing. Unemployment is still very low. The stock market is almost a record high. Inflation has gone all the way from 9% to 3.5%. Why would you mess things up? Why would you change? Just if it ain't broke it, don't fix it.
So when the bond market sends signals that clearly that the trend is changing, I don't think anything. I just sit up in my chair and decide how fast I can drive the bus. You know, I mean, the S&P 10% in 4 weeks got that message loud and clear. Positioning has changed. Sentiment has changed. The whole thing, you know, the gears are moving for a tactical trade higher. There's going to be an ebb and flow to this trade, but this trade is on like Donkey Kong into the end of the year.
Bitcoin broke out 2 weeks before the stock market bottomed, broke out before yields turned, broke out before the dollar turned. So I think I now have a market, whether I trade or not, that is an early indicator of what the rest of risk is going to do. Mm-hmm. And it's been kind of moving sideways, losing momentum for the last week or so. And I wouldn't chase Bitcoin either. I think you'll have a chance to buy it at 30 grand.
Yeah, so very interesting. I mean, there has been that the November move was really powerful, Jeremy. But, you know, to see December step right in with this month, what's your sense? Are you surprised to see investors coming out of the gates right away and resuming that rally in stocks and bonds?
It's all been one trade in so many ways. It's all, you know, the bond market is driving so many things. So we all come back to the Fed and interest rates and how it's all taking shape. And I mean, today, unlike the full year, I mean, it's been a NASDAQ big seven led market. Today, you see the NASDAQ up, I'm showing just 20 basis points right now, but the Russell 2000 up almost 3%, which is massive diversion. And, you know, again, it's the 10-year. Now, what's interesting about all the relationships, I think back to a decade ago in 2013, which was a big year for the markets. Rates were going up. And as you know, you'd think back then often, rising rates is good for the economy, symbol for the economy. Small caps are more cyclical. So you'd say small caps do well with rising rates is one of the things you might have said back then. And today it's like, well, now small caps are facing these funding pressures from, they're the only ones who have bank loans. And so their rates reset with the Fed higher rates. The large caps extended maturities, they're not facing the brunt of all these higher rates from the Fed. So only the small caps do it. So rates go down, small caps fly, you know, which is basically what you started to see a little bit. But, you know, there could be a lot of catch up in small caps. I mean, they are definitely not, you hear everybody, the 493 versus the Magnificent Seven, the valuations are much more supportive to small caps. But the question is, will the economy hold up? Will we have, you know, earnings hold up next year for them? Right? So that's the big question. If you have a falling rates because the economy is slowing down, you know, that's not as positive.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And right now, obviously, we're in this sweet spot because we did get GDP, still looks strong, right? Employment's holding in. So you've got that perfect kind of Goldilocks situation. The issue is, as you say, as we look out into 24, you know, what happens and can we sort of hit that soft landing where the economy is still supportive enough for businesses? You know, Jay Powell was out talking today. The Fed really, from some recent comments, kind of got the ball rolling on this, even from the last meeting. And Jay Powell came out today and he had a chance to sort of really strongly walk it back or try to. I mean, he did say talk of cutting rates was premature, but investors didn't seem to be buying it at all. What should we be expecting from the Fed and rates? I mean, is the market pricing in too many easings right now? I mean, they're disregarding verbally with the Fed saying, how do you see the rates and inflation situation?
If you look out to December next year, Fed funds futures, you get a sense of how many cuts the market is starting to price in. And actually, if you just look at the pricing of the Fed fund futures, you'd say they're starting to think of 5 cuts for next year. Now, one of the things my mentor and senior economist at WisdomTree, Jeremy Siegel, often says is you can't just look at the rates because people buy these futures as a hedge on something bad happens. And so if something bad happens, they have to cut rates a lot more. And so the actual, if you say, like, what does the market actually think the Fed's going to do? It's probably more like 3 to 4. And then you have this other 25 basis point that's sort of like this hedge for something going bad factor that's sort of pushing up pushing those rate cuts higher just because it's a good hedge asset. But, you know, we'd say it's appropriate for them to be cutting. We've been talking about the disinflationary trends we see in our data. We've been calculating this alternative inflation metric that factors in some more real-time housing data. And, you know, one of the things is, you know, the headline inflation, and when they were first saying inflation was much transitory in 2021, you got up to 8% CPI. Our numbers were like 13.5% because of just what was happening in housing. Then our numbers started crashing, you know, much faster than the official numbers. And you're hearing some people talk about, all right, well, what are we doing in this? Is we're just playing more real-time shelter. And you have people like Austin Goolsbee saying, hey, all of inflation boils down to what happens in housing and shelter. And that's what we're showing in this chart is how much lower. We got down to almost a zero handle on headline inflation. You know, the official numbers were 3.2. We're showing 2.2, which is right basically at the target. I think the trajectory, the path for the official numbers are to keep coming down. Although you'll notice my number hooked up a little bit.
What's up with that?
It went off those. We have a chart on core inflation also. If we want to show that one, you know, this was showing. You know, we got up to 4% on. You know, we're down to 4% on core inflation. Our numbers are on 2.5%. You know, I think the dynamic is the shelter inflation. You know, what we're doing is we're substituting Case-Shiller housing data, and you got Case-Shiller housing data in again. And, you know, with 7-8% mortgages, you might have expected more softness. I mean, there was a time we got 7 months in a row of negative housing prints. And, you know, so we were showing much cooler numbers for the shelter inflation. Our number has hooked higher, so it's not quite as low. But we think the traditional metrics will come down. I mean, we do think that there is softening in housing, but that is one of the key things we're watching is will our number keep going higher? Because certainly off the lows from where our number was just a little time ago.
Well, and I think that speaks to one of the concerns out there that people have had is, okay, the inflation's finally moving lower, but are we going to have this second wave of inflation that comes, especially if the economy stays somewhat robust? It's like that's the argument of the inflationistas out there, if you will.
Yes. Well, and we're also saying do not stick to that narrative from the Fed. The Fed, that is one of the biggest risks to the market, is that the Fed sticks to we're going to have the stop and go inflation of the 70s And they, what we call the false narrative of the 70s is, hey, we had these big issues where we loosened too quickly. Now, you know, why do we say it's a false narrative? During the 70s, the money supply kept growing 10% a year. The money, you know, when you think about what the money supply should grow, we like to think of 4 to 5%, and really 5%, as the magic number for money supply to grow. And why? Where do we come up with that? Money supply should be approximating equal to inflation plus real growth in the economy. So if you have 2 to 3% real growth, 2 to 3% inflation, that gets you to 5%. Why did we have the surge in inflation? Well, you had the money supply grow 40% during the pandemic. All the efforts that the government did, they flooded the system with money, and the Fed gave the government the money. The Fed didn't do all the buying of assets that they did, interest rates would have gone up much higher. And so in some ways, the Fed did accommodate. People started giving Powell credit for getting inflation back down. I said, well, no, he sort of like you crash into somebody and then you take him to the hospital. Like, they did create the inflation. Yes, now it's coming down, but inflation, the above trend inflation was a reflection of the above trend money. Well, money supply started declining. And it actually, earlier this year, we were really worried because money supply was sharply negative as it was since the Great Depression. Like, you hadn't really seen declines, and you had to go back to the Great Depression to see declines in the money supply. And during the 70s, again, it was growing at 10% a year. So that is not what we have today. It stopped declining. It hooked a little bit higher, but it's not growing at the 5% rate we would like it to. So that is one of the deflationary factors in there that, you know, you can, if the Fed, this is part of the thing, we think the Fed needs to be patient. You need to let the data, particularly the shelter data, come their way next year. And again, the money supply is nothing like the 70s.
Hey everyone, we're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
One of the things when people look at housing is this concern that you're only going to get so much easing off in prices because there's a shortage of supply. And it'll, you know, there's a longer lag in terms of trying to catch up with supply on that. Is that worrisome, or is that it's really that rate of decline that matters for, and, you know, there may be a floor, you're not going to see it collapse, but that you're not going to see that feed into inflation?
Yeah, you know, interestingly, coincidence is you saw the money supply go from March 2020, March 22, 40% higher. The Case-Shiller index went up 40% from that period. And so that was an interesting coincidence of people looking at shelters, one of those nice inflation hedges over the long run. People were buying. The demographics seemed to be supportive for housing. We would have thought with 7-8% mortgage, you would have gotten a deeper correction. Really didn't. But it has cooled down considerably. And some of the anecdotes that we hear is that it's continuing to cool down. But yes, that supply constraint is what you hear all the time. People trying to justify price. And people say, oh, they know they're going to refinance eventually, so they don't care about paying the 7% mortgage. And there's some truth to that. If I was advising friends to say, yeah, you know, the mortgage rate, you're probably going to get a chance to refinance much lower. So you don't have to be overly concerned. And so I all that narrative does make sense. We didn't think you had to erase all the gains in housing, but you would have thought you might come down 10% off the highs. You didn't quite get there. We'll see how that goes. But I think that the official data that Powell looks at is going to get better throughout the course of the year. And I think, you know, the official CPI statistics will come their way.
So it gets better. But does that mean they've got to cut? I mean, there's, you know, like, and you have even have Ackman saying he thinks he's even ahead of the market Bill Ackman coming out and saying he thinks, so clearly he's concerned of a more serious slowdown. So maybe the question isn't do they cut, is where's the risk that things slow down markedly from here?
Well, it does come back to this sort of question of what is the right neutral rate? You know, like Powell uses the word, we are well into restrictive territory. You know, well into restrictive territory was a quote you kept hearing. And if they have 5.30 as their rate and inflation is really coming back to 2-3%, their real rate is, even if it was 3%, if you just took headline inflation today at 3%, their real rates, call it 2%. You know, if it actually gets down to 2%, the trend actually gets to CPI of 2%. Now the real rate's 3%. You know, the long-term neutral, maybe 1.5 to 2. So they're very restricted. Right. So this when the real rate gets much above what is sort of neutral, where they're not too aggressive, they're not too tightening and they're not too loose. Where does that neutral rate stand out? And so I do think there's going to be some concern that they just drive more unemployment than is necessary. Do you really want to kick out 1 million to 2 million workers from their jobs because you're at 2.5% instead of 2% inflation, like in an election season? You know, so I think that is the. We think there's going to be a lot of pressure. You know, Powell's going to want to keep his job. So I think he's not going to want to overly throw us into a recession, cause all this extra unemployment because they're keeping rates too high.
Yeah.
If the actual inflation is going to come their way. They do.
Well, not to mention they missed it on, you know, in terms of get inflation getting away from them. They want to make an error on the downside as well, you know, of getting that timing wrong. ISM came out today, speaking of where weakness is, and it was subdued again, right? It was the 13th month, I think, below 50. It seems like we keep saying, like, when's there a recession? Some people might point to manufacturing and saying we're kind of already in one.
Right. There's signs of the slowdown. There are signs, and the higher they stay at above 5, the more risk they create. So that's why we think they should be talking about it. You know, in some of their previous quotes, they're like, we're not even talking about lowering rates. We do think they should start talking about it. And, you know, how quickly they do it will obviously be dependent on the official inflation data and how much more unemployment starts to pick up. But you're coming into the year-end budgeting season, planning season. People will be focused on margins and how they manage their cost bases going forward. You'll see where it does unemployment go over the coming months. And I think you could, if there's more signs of weakness, obviously the chance of rate cuts come in sooner.
Yeah. Should we worry that the ISM number is a sign of what's to come for the rest of the economy? Are they leading, showing us that things are starting to crater, or do you think that is that sector kind of is working on its own dynamics?
I think
AJ asking what you make of that number.
It's just one of the signs of weaknesses. I mean, there's absolutely, it's one of the signs. China certainly, you say, like, who, we think about the global economy of Europe is definitely showing more sluggish signs of recession. They're battled in the war. They've got all sorts of issues in Europe, but not a lot of strong growth in Europe. You have China, who's dealing with its real estate crisis. They are not an engine of global growth at the moment. They're not showing, people are keep calling for, well, when will they actually stimulate and help reignite excitement about their ramifications, spillovers across the rest of emerging markets? That's not coming. We don't see any signs of that. Xi keeps talking about high quality growth, which is they're not going to really overstimulate. So you don't see China taking the growth baton. Europe's not taking the growth baton. U.S., we've got these higher rates. So you could see the sort of global sluggishness that is there.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Ralph asking, do you have any thoughts on the direction of the yuan? Actually, before we get to that, let's talk about the dollar. The dollar, so everything's rallying. The dollar's not. The dollar has been falling substantially as the market prices in these rate cuts. Does that feel like that's going to continue to be the trend? There's some pretty bearish predictions for the dollar out there.
Well, I think a lot of, well, you see today, again, I come back to, it's all one trade. It's like what's happening to the 10-year is coming into all these markets. So, you know, you got the yen to the Japanese yen, you're getting to 151, 152, and the 10-year was approaching 5%. We've come off 80 basis points. So, you know, there's just less of that carry trade in treasuries versus their own local market. The euro at 108, I mean, I've talked to some people who think the euro should be fair value at 90 cents. And so, you know, I don't know if the euro can keep rallying just be off of the weakness from the Fed. I mean, you definitely see gold as one of those hedges against the dollar doing very well. But again, I think that's tied to the low rate phenomena, that there's less of a competition for gold with some of these things. So it all comes back to what happens to this 10-year is going to drive these other markets. It's going to be, it could pressure stocks. It could pressure, the dollar could go back in the other direction if the 10-year were to start rising again.
Which has really been the case all year, right? I mean, that's where the volatility's been, and that's what's been leading. So you sent over some interesting charts, a sort of scorecard of 80 ETFs. I think this is really interesting because one of the questions we get is, okay, so if we're in a new regime now, what's going to work as we head into 2024, right? Like where do we want to be positioned, or what do we want our portfolios to look like? So what is this telling you in terms of performance and what that might indicate for 2024?
So I showed sort of top and bottom, so top five and bottom five. We can look at both of them. But in terms of what was at the leaderboard this year, it was AI-driven stocks. So things like a cybersecurity ETF or cyber, then U.S. quality growth. This is where you're positioned the Magnificent Seven stocks. That QGRW sort of quality growth selection had all the Magnificent Seven as their top weights. The way we select for profitability and growth rates got all seven of them. But then you get Japan, actually two Japan funds trading like AI stocks. You know, and you have value investors like Buffett who's been buying Japan. I still think Japan is one of the cheapest markets globally. I think it's benefiting from moving away from China. I actually think Japan and India, if you're sort of a global investor, are benefiting from the pivot away from China. But I do sort of joke that you get these value stocks in Japan trading like AI, because the other three ETFs on this list is one is a pure AI fund, and one is cyber tied to all this tech world, and then one's Magnificent Seven that's benefiting from all AI. So I'd say if anything, I'm bullish on Japan on the what's continuing leaderboard. I mean, I think the valuations are the most supportive for the future. If I go to what's not been working, it's you have high dividend U.S. stocks on the list. That's DHS, the sort of traditional value has been down when you saw sort of that those AI quality growth up 40. So just a huge dispersion from value versus quality growth. I like the value stocks is a little bit more, well, certainly more reasonably priced, or 10 PEs on that high dividend basket. To me, that's, I think, for people playing a little bit of the long-term value rotation, mean reversion, that's, to me, one of my favorite ways of expressing that. Even though it was negative this year, I think that's part of the reason to look at it for next year. China was on the negative side, big negative this year. I'm not buying the value trade on that one, per se. I think that I do a podcast every week called Behind the Markets on SiriusXM 132. It'll be playing actually right after we get off at 5 o'clock again, if you're on Sirius. But we talked with a woman, Liza Tobin. She's from a group called SCSP.AI, Special Competitive Studies Project. It was funded by Eric Schmidt. Oh. And they focus a lot on AI and the competition with China. They want to see, can they bring back high tech to the U.S. and try to make the U.S. as competitive as it possible in this sort of global competition, but particularly with respect to China, particularly with respect to AI. And it just feels like the tension with China is going to be there for a long time. And so you have their own economic issues. You have the geopolitical side. I think we're going to go from talking about all Fed to all talking about geopolitics as we look ahead over the coming years. So I think China is not quite one that I'm buying the value side. But on that list was biotech. I think biotech is one of the unloved beneficiaries of AI. I'm reading a book now by Jamie Metzl.
Jamie Metzl.
Do you know Jamie?
Yeah.
He's a great, great guy. He's got a new book coming out. Super
really interesting character. Yeah. So he just put a book out on that. I didn't realize that.
Interesting. Oh, well, it's coming. I got a preview.
Oh, okay. Great.
It's coming out in June. But he's got me real excited about this concept. And we actually work with him on this biorevolution concept. But it's the convergence of AI to the biotech field, when you think about all, you know, mapping of the genome, it's all just data. And so the AI is going to change.
Listen, we lived through it. The COVID vaccine.
Yes.
That was an early example of like just crunching an enormous amount. I mean, you need cooperation too, which would be interesting to ask him about if it's data sets in terms of sharing them, whether it's academia or nation states.
Yes.
But, you know, like that opened a door about what would be possible if everyone got together and decided they wanted to do that. And so that is the power, and add quantum computing on that. Super, super interesting idea.
Yeah, so when I look at it being down last year and being on the list of the top worst performers, I think of that as just, and it's been down 3 years in a row. So biotech's been down 3 years in a row. And so
why has it been down so much, Jeremy?
Well, there was obviously a lot of excitement, and they were sort of the ultimate COVID play. So there was a lot of move that came from that. And then see, people have just been taking it off, and they've been moving their growth money elsewhere to this other traditional AI stories. But and yes, the speed you can innovate in just software and things like the LL, those ChatGPT and all these things that people are seeing tangibly. It's harder to see the research that takes a long time to develop and is one drug at a time. But
you have to go through FDA and some of the other regulatory
time. But I think it's meaningful. Like, so if you had to say, where is AI going to have a real impact for the next 10 years? This is the space I have actually a lot of confidence in.
That's so interesting. That's a really interesting thought, I have to say. I want to flip back to China for a second. You know, Xi and Biden just met, and there were some attempts for the Chinese to try to put an olive branch out, maybe to foreign direct investment. It sounds like you're skeptical. Does anybody feel differently? Because not only do you have going into election year the idea that the geopolitical rhetoric will heat up and be adversarial, certainly, at least between the US and China. But China itself has a track record of stamping out, I mean, you know, the sort of tech innovation and revolution that was so strong there with their own moves. What would it take to kind of reassure investors or restore that investor confidence in the China story?
The foreign direct investment is definitely at real low levels. People are moving away. You see big companies like Apple saying they're going to have to start investing in India, but it's not easy to move this overnight, right? Like
supply chain. Yeah. There's
not easy. I mean, what's fascinating, you had, I'm sure a lot of our listeners here saw on Twitter, Elon's conversation with Andrew Ross Sorkin this week, where he talked about, you know, after Tesla, he thinks the next 9 of the 10 largest car companies might come out of China, just how strong the competition in China is. And they're actually going up the value chain and not just producing low cost, you know, t-shirts. They're actually producing some real high quality stuff.
Well, they cornered the EV, the battery market is, you know, that's key to that, right? And the supply chain. But will the environment be such that they can export that globally? Will people let them into the markets in the way that will enable them to be a force outside of China?
Yeah, well, I think Europe is more likely than the US. I think, you know, the US has took some actions. There's actually an executive order right now to study a few critical areas like artificial intelligence, quantum computing. And so there was thoughts that we would do more. We're trying to restrict some of the private investments. There was a big news item where Sequoia was having this venture capital or private capital fund that was going to put like $3 billion into tech, like AI tech, semiconductors, that essentially they viewed as funding our enemies. And, you know, the government was like, oh, we shouldn't do that. And then the question was going to go from private companies to public companies. And I had heard that they might make it tougher to invest in some of these companies because you had all these sanctions with Russia. You sort of have this memory of what happened there. And, you know, China is not like Russia was. I mean, Russia was a small weight in traditional emerging markets portfolios. China got up to 40% of the MSCI index. Now it's around 30 after the big pullback. But could they make it more difficult? You know, Biden they did do this executive order. They did talk about making it harder. It's out there for public comment right now. But Biden's been sort of going along with the European lines. He's trying to make it a global approach and going, what does our European allies want to also do so that we're not being an outlier there? The question will be, if you get a Republican in, if Trump comes back? Is that going to make it tougher on China in some way? So let's see. I mean, there's definitely, it's not a crystal clear case on those tensions ameliorating over the next 12 months.
Yeah. And it's going to, and, you know, as always in an election year anywhere, but certainly in the US, by the way, I think next year is a massive election year everywhere. I think there was, I saw a stat that there's an enormous amount of elections going on. The difficult part is often separating the rhetoric from policy, because campaign rhetoric is something very different than actual legislation, law, or executive order. And that's thrown off investors, certainly globally in the past, when they hear things being said, like, are they actually then put into effect? That's going to be tricky for us all to navigate. A lot of really interesting stuff. Love bringing up the value rotation and the biotech conversation, Jeremy. That was really interesting. It was great to see you. Thanks for being on with us.
Well, thanks for having me. Have a good weekend here. Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. And thanks to all of you. Hope you enjoy your weekend. We will see you next week. In the meantime, take care and good luck out there.
People are going to lose their minds. This is a moment in history unlike anything humanity's gone through. It's a very different world for humans to come.
Take a step back and see the broad picture, which is the way all these technologies are interlinked.
Because this is all about exponentiality, and humans can't think in exponential terms.
How consequential do you want to say machine intelligence is? It's almost certainly as consequential as writing. How long did writing take to disseminate through the human population? You know, hundreds, thousands of years. And we're dealing with it now on a scale of months.
But in this kind of world, you're compounding 100% growth every year, and the numbers become astronomical.
AI is going to spot patterns in the world that were just completely invisible to us.
Even if you think that the AI and the robots are your demise, you might as well bloody invest in them and make some money out of it. If not, you're just going to be angry man shaking your fists at the clouds.